This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
local villagers have blamed the tragedy on negligence, saying they had complained to authorities that the dam was leaking.
That's VOA's Rael Ombor on the deadly collapse of a dam in Kenya. Details coming up.
Also, Kenya has taken its first step into space with the launch today of a nano satellite made at the University of Nairobi. And the World Health Organization has put nine nations around the DRC on alert due to an outbreak of Ebola.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Kenya has taken its first step into space with the launch today of a nano satellite made at the University of Nairobi. Engineers involved in creating the cube-shaped space capsule described it as Kenya's joining the space club. Although much remains to be done to get the program off the ground, VOA's Daniel Sheriff reports from Nairobi.
Let's go together. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. 4, 3, 2, 1.
Kenyans cheered as a live stream broadcast Friday at the University of Nairobi showed the country's first homemade satellite being launched from the International Space Station. Japan's space agency deployed the small cube-shaped nano-satellite using an airlock and robotic platform called Kibo, the only way to launch CubeSats. The space capsule was designed by students and scientists at the university. They celebrated the landmark achievement. Faith Karanja, a senior lecturer with the Department of Geospatial and Space Technology, worked on the satellite program. She says the successful launch shows Kenya has now joined other nations in the space club.
It has really taken us to the next level because really what we have been doing is we have just been users of space technology, space science and technology. In fact, we were in the category where we were calling ourselves space aspiring nation. In as far as now we are concerned, once the deployment has been done and it is successful, we are in the same league as the spacefaring nation.
Kenya's space agency was established just last year and has done little since, however. While the nano satellite represents a step toward a viable space program in Kenya, it's a baby step that has required a lot of help. The nano satellite is quite small, 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters, and it weighs only 1.2 kilograms. The small satellite was designed with the help of experts from Italy's Sapienza University of Rome and Japan's Aerospace Exploration Agency, JAXA. Japan funded much of the venture, spending about $1 million on the project. And while Kenyans did much of the technology design work, the satellite was taken to the space station in April by a SpaceX rocket during a resupply mission. Nonetheless, Kenyan engineering students like Lucy Rodo are impressed with the achievements so far. She says she is very happy because this program comes at a time when some of Kenya's students left abroad to study geospatial and space technology, leaving their universities. She is extremely happy, she says, because she knows when they are there, they will know that they can compete with a space program. The University of Nairobi is already making plans for further satellite development. Peter Gao is head of the College of Architecture and Engineering.
Our next step is one to try to make the next bigger size of this nano satellite. The one we have done is called 1U. We need to make 3U. 3U can contain high resolution camera. It can also contain equipment for communication. So this one will require another 1 year to make.
Gao says the university has sent three Kenyan students for advanced science degrees at Japan's Kyushu Institute of Technology, famous for nanosatellite testing. The University of Nairobi says Kenya's first satellite will be used to collect data on wildlife, weather forecasting, disaster management, and food security, among other goals. Daniel Sheriff, VOA News, Nairobi.
More than 40 people were killed after a dam burst Wednesday night in Kenya's Rift Valley, and many others are still missing following heavy rains. Authorities say the dam was built illegally on private land, and residents fear other dams built without permission could collapse, causing more misery. Rael Ombor reports from Nairobi.
The dam known by locals as the Patel Dam was one of seven in the Solai area of Nakuru town, located on a private farm. It broke open Wednesday night, sweeping away hundreds of homes, according to officials. Such efforts continued Friday, with rescue workers hoping to find survivors trapped in the mud and debris. James Kimani barely escaped death when the dam burst on Wednesday. I had carried two people on my motorbike. Both of them were swept away. They died, but I managed to hang to a tree. When I reached home, I found that everything and everyone had been carried away. Local villagers have blamed the tragedy on negligence, saying they had complained to authorities that the dam was leaking. The director of public prosecutions has directed police to establish the cause and culpability, if any, of Wednesday's disaster and give him the results of the investigations within 14 days. And Kenya's Water Resources Management Authority, which regulates private dams, said Friday that the Patel Dam and the other dams on the property did not have the required permits. Solai resident Helen Wanjiru said that the remaining dams still present a danger. There are so many dams around this area, and they will continue to cause more damage. This man has built a lot of dams, and these dams are starting to fall apart. Where do they want us to go? Interior Cabinet Secretary Fred Matiang'i visited the scene Thursday and said the government was taking steps to determine the stability of the other six dams.
We have lost a lot of lives here, and this is very tragic. This is now not time to waste any minute on anything.
Noela Namulanda is the communications manager of the Kenya Red Cross. She told VOA that the death toll of the Solai tragedy stood at 42 and could still rise. Meanwhile, the Red Cross is still trying to help survivors.
The most crucial thing is to try and help them recover from this. So we are putting up temporary shelters. We're also doing psychosocial support to families and the community. We're also involved in the search and rescue and offering evacuation services, something at least to help them be back on their feet in the interim as we look for long-term solutions.
Weeks of torrential rain have caused flooding and mudslides across Kenya. The downpours that began in March have left close to 200 people dead. Government statistics released Wednesday show that more than 220,000 people have been displaced by flooding. Rael Ombur for VOA News, Nairobi.
Much-delayed peace talks for South Sudan are scheduled to pick up again next Thursday in Ethiopia's capital. Analysts say the diplomatic efforts won't succeed unless East African leaders use both carrots and sticks to force the warring sides to compromise. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
South Sudan has been mired in fresh conflict for nearly 2 years, since a power-sharing deal collapsed in July of 2016. VOA spoke to the head of the UN mission in South Sudan, David Shearer, about the agenda for the upcoming peace talks in Addis Ababa.
The two issues on the table, which are the most fundamental, is, you know, security sector. What's the shape of the army, the armed forces are going to look like if you bring all those parties together? And the second thing, obviously, is the constitution and the governance. Who governs? What's the progress towards ultimately to elections, and how's that going to happen? So it's a little unclear at the moment exactly where everybody sits on that spectrum of being able to come together.
Efforts to hold the talks this year has been mired in delays. Opposition and rebel groups have demanded the departure of President Salva Kiir. The government has pushed for elections, though many, including the United States, doubt a credible vote is possible under current conditions. The African Union maintains that negotiations is the best route to peace and stability in South Sudan. However, the five previous deals mediated by East African Regional Bloc IGAD have failed. James Okuk teaches political science at Juba University.
IGAD is looking for the government or the opposition to come up with something. I don't think they will come up. It's for the IGAD now to find what is really a middle way that they can propose. And if they propose that middle way, then that middle way is what should be negotiated by those parties.
A lot has changed since the 2016 clashes that forced rebel leader Riek Machar from Juba. More rebel groups and armed groups have emerged, and the government forces have retaken ground. There is tension within the opposition camp. One group has agreed to join Kiir's proposed unity government, while the other faction is staying away and wants to revive the 2015 peace agreement. Machar allies say he will not accept Kiir's invitation to return to the country and reconcile without a peace deal. Casey Copeland is a researcher with the International Crisis Group in Nairobi. She says the sides will need pressure or incentives to reach a peace deal and follow through with it.
And we don't necessarily see the international community having a well-organized strategy to provide that. So what I fear is that this diplomatic effort that's going on might not actually achieve anything because it's not backed up with the sort of support of the region to really try and shift the views of the conflict parties.
Aid agencies warn of severe hunger and say parts of the country once again risk famine this year. Thousands have been killed since the war began in late 2013, and to date, more than 4 million South Sudanese have been forced from their homes. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The World Health Organization has put nine nations around the Democratic Republic of Congo on alert due to an outbreak of Ebola. Of particular concern are the Republic of Congo and the Central African Republic, which have connections to the affected area through river systems. In Uganda, the Ministry of Health worries about the thousands of refugees who have streamed into the country from the DRC. VOA's Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
The Ebola outbreak was confirmed about 3 days ago in the town of Bikoro, 1,945 kilometers from the Ugandan border. At least two deaths have been confirmed as being caused by Ebola, and there are dozens of suspected cases. With over 10 districts at the border with the DRC, Uganda is taking the outbreak very seriously. Uganda is experiencing a surge in population of DRC nationals within its territory. Most have come in as refugees, while others have daily businesses in Uganda. To keep Ebola out of Uganda, all travelers from DRC are now being screened at all major entry points. Vivian Nakalika is a spokesperson of Uganda's health ministry.
Surveillance has been heightened at all border points, at all the 12 districts at the Uganda-DRC border, and also two districts, including Kampala and Wakiso, which are, you know, the central districts, and Entebbe, where we do have the international airports.
She says the ministry has reinstated Ebola screening points at Entebbe Airport and high-risk districts.
We've established health desks where passengers, travelers, and also people moving from DR Congo, that's for the other entry points, are screened for symptoms and signs of Ebola.
District leaders have also been asked to reactivate district task forces in preparation for any possible outbreak in the country. According to a Ministry of Health statement, a private medical center in the airport has been equipped to provide counseling and clinical screening to all suspects. A standby ambulance with a driver and relevant protective gear has been provided by the Civil Aviation Authority and is available 24/7. Ebola is a highly hemorrhagic viral fever that affects humans and primates. Death rate from the disease ranges from 25% to 99%, with an incubation period between 2 to 21 days. Ebola can spread from person to person through contact with blood, secretions, organs, or other bodily fluids of infected people. Early symptoms include sudden onset of fever, fatigue, muscle pain, headache and sore throat, which subsequently leads to vomiting and diarrhea. Uganda's Ministry of Health has advised the public to remain vigilant and report any suspected cases of Ebola. Sarah Opendi is Uganda's Minister of State for Health.
If somebody comes up with signs similar to Ebola, they shouldn't simply just look for maybe malaria and so on. They should also ensure that the samples are sent to the Uganda Virus Research Institute so that confirmatory tests can be undertaken.
Uganda has had a number of Ebola outbreaks, with the latest one reported in 2012 in Chibale district, which led to the death of four people. The current outbreak in the DRC is in three separate locations in a remote area covering 60 kilometers or more. It's a 19-hour trip by motorbike to the nearest town, but there are concerns it could reach Mbandaka, the provincial capital of 1 million people. The WHO is waiting for DRC's final approval to ship in an experimental vaccine to the scene and says it only needs the government's final authorization. It also hopes to send in a mobile laboratory this weekend. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
20 minutes past the hour, this is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. In Cape Town, some enterprises that depend on water to make money are struggling to stay in business as the city endures one of the most serious droughts ever in South Africa. Some factories have drilled their own wells. Other companies have invested heavily in systems that recycle water. In our series on the Cape's water crisis, Darren Taylor takes a look at how two businesses from different sides of Cape Town's social spectrum are surviving.
It's a sight you don't expect to see in a place where the city administration has asked residents to use no more than 50 litres of water each a day. Children careening down gushing slides into pools of fresh water. This is Water World, a fun park based entirely around water, of course. Its manager, Markham Adams, says he and the owners never anticipated intense water shortages in Cape Town, which once boasted some of the highest rainfall figures in South Africa. But 12 years ago, they found a water source beneath their feet, as Adam says.
All of our water we use in the slides is all well point water. It's off the municipal grid. It's been off for the last 8-9 years. You've got the Lawrence River just adjacent to us here running into the sea, and I think it's probably a lot of that underground water from the Lawrence River that we're picking up.
A pump extracts water from one of the two wells that keep Water World open.
We did write to the municipality and said to them, listen, we understand the pressure on fresh water and drinking water. If we don't use the water, it just flows further down into the sea anyway. So just understand the logic that there's no other person that can use the water that needs it for farming or whatever else. So they said, look, the logic makes sense, so we'll leave you for now.
But as Adams explains, some other venues that rely on water haven't been as fortunate as Waterworld.
All of your parks that run on municipal water, they've all been closed. Your municipal swimming pools, they've all been closed.
Adam says now that the drought's really biting, mothers and their children often arrive at Waterworld in the early evening.
They pop in here at about 5:30. They're in here for 15 minutes and the mums jokingly say they've had their bath for the night, so they're not to use.
The business has a regular supply of fresh water, but still saves as much as possible.
Wherever you look, you see we're catching all of the water. When it comes out of the slides, you can see it's being collected. There's drains collecting water wherever it runs back into a reservoir.
From there, the water is reused. Far away from the middle-class haven of Water World, in Cape Town's Khayelitsha Township, 26-year-old Philip Tutsi and his car washer colleagues also depend on water for work.
When the rain is raining, we fetch water and we wash car. Even taxis, that water, we fetch it by the drain like this.
These days, it hardly rains, but Tutsi says the sewers of the overpopulated shack land are always bursting with wastewater.
That water, it flows every day, doesn't stop. We go there, we take the buckets and we pour, we take water after we go and wash out their cars.
So this is the water now that's flowing in the drains of the city where you and other people come and collect water.
Yeah, yes, chief. To wash car and do many things, even clothes we can wash it.
Okay.
But not to cook because this is dirty.
He says he used to collect water at a communal water point, but doesn't anymore because since the drought, there's too much violence there.
I see there's a lot of fighting because when we go to the water, we queue. The water starts from 7:30. By 8 o'clock, they close the tank.
This, Tutsi says, means many people are left without water, and sometimes they fight one another for it.
Like I can take a stone and hit you, or I can do the wrong thing to you, because also me, I need water. But if I doesn't care water, my child and my family doesn't going to eat and wash and survive without water.
South Africans like Tutsi have always suffered to access water during times of water plenty and scarcity. Still, says the young man, life is good because he's working and he doesn't need his own tap to make his way through life. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Cape Town.
Members of Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika's party, the National Liberation Front, want him to seek a fifth term in next year's election, despite concerns over his health. The party has dominated Algerian political life since its independence from France in 1962. Some experts on Algerian politics say the party not only must deal with questions over Bouteflika's health, it must continue to push economic reforms. Azzedine Laïchi is Algerian-American professor of government and politics at St. John's University in New York. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi about the challenges for Algerian politicians.
It depends on how the exit will be, whether he will finish his term. If he finishes his term, the possibility of a fifth term, you know, is a tough one, but it is not impossible. And if he dies in office, there will be a temporary president, definitely. And we could see easily the current prime minister, Yahya, to take that lead. He's known. He may not be liked by everybody, but I think he's the best for now that Algeria has. And then new elections will be held. And of course, the powers that be in Algeria will be deciding who will be the most likely to be accepted by the population. And there will be some kind of campaign for that person. That person may not necessarily be an unknown person. It has to be a known person that might get the approval of at least the conservative part of Algeria, which wants stability, security, not necessarily democracy.
Algeria has been depending on oil and gas as the main source of national income. Is there any effort being made to diversify sources of income in Algeria?
Yeah, there were big efforts today. They said like in emergency mode. There were many problems that have prevented that from happening in the past. First, the huge income from oil. Now that has become a liability. The government is trying to move on, one, changing the private investment laws in Algeria, making it much easier for not only Algerian investors, but also foreign investors to invest in Algeria, because that has been a big problem. There were issues with the banking system. There were issues with transparency, issues with corruption at the highest level of government and so on. All these things that have been preventing the birth and development of private sector, now it is very urgent. The government knows that it has to stop relying on hydrocarbons for its survival. And so therefore, there is a move towards that. They're trying to make it much easier for companies, small companies, to be born and to thrive. But there is always resistance, because there are some people who do control monopolies in many areas and they don't want any competition. And so it's going to be a tough fight, but Algeria has no other way to go but that route, which is the development of a non-hydrocarbon economy.
Would the economic challenges facing Algeria force a departure from the stagnant political system that has been existing in Algeria for a long time?
Not necessarily, unfortunately. If the economy gets slightly better, there are a little bit more jobs and more social services provided, not too many people would be worried about political reform. But if things get really tough, just like it happened in October in 1988 with the riots, sudden political opening, then we might be seeing a push for not only serious political reforms, but also for a new generation of leaders. Bouteflika goes back to the war against France, and this is just insane. We have, you know, 70% of the population is under 30 years old, and they're being led by people who did the war against France in the 1950s. So hopefully that change will happen sooner rather than later, and peacefully rather than violently.
That was Azzedine Laïchi, an Algerian-American professor of government and politics at St. John's University in New York. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the VOA.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.